Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and while I'm waiting for my guest, Tess Gerritsen, to call in, there are a couple of people I would like to thank. We're going to be talking about her book, Playing with Fire. I'm going to be talking about the music, the Encendido Waltz, and hopefully she'll get here soon. I'd like to thank the people at Small Cakes in Scarsdale for the outstanding job that they did creating 12 of the most delicious cupcakes for my nephew's 40th birthday. So thank you so much, and I guarantee we're going to all come right back to you. I would also like to thank a very special man from Rye Playland. His name is Sammy, and he works in a place called Perky's. And without him, my nephew and I wouldn't have had dinner, and my husband one night, because they were the only show in town, only restaurant in town, and this guy makes the best pizza in the whole world. I would also like to thank the people of Fountain Diner for going out of their way for me. Okay, there's more to come. Tess, hi.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's a beautiful day here. How about you?
It's nice. We're on the air, and it's beautiful outside over here, thank God. The podcast stopped, so this is great because this book was fantastic.
Well, thank you very much.
When you created this plot, how come you created the music to go with it, the Encendido? It makes a difference because I listen to it. And
well,
I
never planned to compose the music. The whole project came together in a very strange way. It started off with a dream. The story came to me in a dream. And about halfway through writing the story, the music came to me in another dream. So it was all delivered to me from some strange subconscious place.
That's different.
Yeah,
completely
different.
And then you just sort of put it together.
Yeah.
You sort of put it together.
Well, I think I almost, in a way, I feel as if it was given to me by, I don't know, some from the universe, because the story was meant to be told, and I was just the one to deliver it.
Well, it's scary. It was scary to think that a child wants to kill her mother.
Well,
then you read it in the news anyway.
Yeah, well, that was the jumping off place. That was the, you know, that was the original. You know, the story began when I was in Venice for my birthday, and I had a nightmare. And the nightmare was that I was playing my violin, some kind of really beautiful, odd piece of music, and there was a baby sitting next to me. And while I was playing my violin, the baby's eyes glowed red, and she turned into a monster. And so that began the whole idea of music and children who are evil, and is it possible for music to change a child or make a child behave in a strange way? And the plot just grew from there. So, I know that there are a lot of things in the story that twist and turn, and lest people worry about this child actually being evil, they should finish the story and find out.
Well, that's true, because I'm not going to tell them.
No.
Seriously,
it's
not.
There is a huge spoiler in here that I'm trying to avoid talking about, but let's just say that things are not always what they appear to be.
That's exactly true. And I began to wonder about that while I was reading. So this is told, a lot of authors are doing it. And, of course, when you do it, it was easy to understand because you had the chapter title. I have the book in front of me. I have the proof. I don't have the real one. But, ouch, my hand. It was easy to follow back and forth because you had the different time periods at the head of the chapter or before the chapter. When some authors do it and you go like, what? Huh?
Well, it also helps that Julia's sections, the mother with the troubled child, are told in the first person. And the historical sections that go back to where this music comes from are told in the third person. Just to back up and tell the listeners a little bit more about the plot. So the story is partly about a woman, a violinist, who picks up a piece of handwritten music in an antique store in Rome, brings it home to Boston, and every time she plays it, her three-year-old daughter becomes violent, does something really horrible. and she thinks maybe it has something to do with this piece of music that she plays on her violin. Is there something evil about this melody, and where does it come from? So she, to save her family, to save her own sanity, because everyone's doubting her stories, she goes back to Italy to find out where the music comes from. And in intervening chapters throughout the story, we go back 70 years to the composer to see where the music came from, why he composed it, how he composed it. And he is an Italian Jew who lives in Venice, and it's the eve of World War II. And we see what happens to his family, how he comes to write this music. But most important, we see a love story, how he falls in love with his cellist, a lovely young girl. And she loves him back, and everything is happy, and they adore each other, and then the war comes, and what becomes of them. So it's a story about the past, a love story in the past, and it's a story which is more of a suspense story told in the present. And how these things, these two stories are connected is this one piece of music called Incendio, which is a very sad and haunting waltz that seems to have this strange power over Julia's little girl.
Well, I sat and listened to it, and it does have strange powers. It sounds like the devil's chords. It does. I listened to it a couple of times.
Yeah, the music when I wrote it didn't exist. It was just a fictional piece of music. But as I mentioned, while I was writing the story and I was describing this fictional piece of music for the purpose of storytelling, I think those descriptions must have somehow seeped into my subconscious, because that's where the second dream came from. I woke up and the melody was in my head, and so since I play the piano and the violin, I was able to compose it. It took me about 6 weeks in total, but I wanted to use a lot of the elements I described, and one of them is, you mentioned, devil's chords. If you're not, people aren't musicians, they don't know what that means, but it's a particular interval with two notes. What we would say, musically is it's an augmented fourth interval. And it's an uncomfortable two notes to listen to. It's just a little bit off, and it makes you uneasy, and it might kind of jar you a little bit. And in the medieval church, musicians were not allowed to play these chords in the church because they were thought to be evil. And that's where they got the name Devil's Chords. I write about that, and of course when I composed the music, I had to put quite a few of these in the composition itself.
No, I heard them. They're beautiful. I play the violin too.
Oh, you do? That's,
in college,
yeah.
I did. And the violin has a voice of its own. I play the piano too, but the violin had a different kind of voice. I found that when I was stressed out or something was bothering me, I picked up the violin and it just sort of calmed me down, depending on what I wanted to play.
Go ahead.
No, the hardest thing I think was to have to compose my own music for the piano and violin. I was like, oh my God! In order to graduate, I had to do that, and it didn't quite come out like yours. But I did attempt to. I did attempt to do it, and I had to transpose it in every single key. Oh my God!
I love talking to other violinists, because I always have this question. Now, is this a violin you've had for a long time?
My dad bought it for me when he realized I was serious, when I was about 10. And the history behind it is, I think it's got a Stradivarius inside, but it was a Kanabi outside. And somewhere in this, I still have it. I need to get it restrung and whatever. But he bought it for me because he felt that I was going to be serious. And I'll never forget, in junior high school, I was out for a week, so I wasn't well. And somebody actually took my first violin chair when I came back, and I said, "Don't get used to it." And I got it back. it was a thing. I said, it was the one thing that mattered to me. I said, I need that chair back. You're not getting it. Forget it. You're out of here.
Wow. So you were first violin.
I was first violinist concert mistress, and I swear it was like the hardest thing to do, because the minute you played a wrong note, you knew you were going to lose the chair.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's right. You're always defending your position. I know. Well, you must.
Yeah,
you
it's,
must,
it's
you,
hard.
You're very a very good violinist. I love hearing stories about where people got their instruments, because as you know, the violin is very much a living. It's a living instrument. It's made of wood and And if you don't play a violin often enough, it starts to go to sleep. The wood starts to change a little bit. And I talk a lot about violins and how it's the one. It's one of the few instruments, that and the cello, where you actually put it up against your body. So when it vibrates, you feel it. You feel it in your bones, and it becomes like part of your body. And there's something really almost, I don't know, this is so organic to play a wood instrument like that. And every single instrument is different, and that's what's so I guess fascinating about violins is each one has a personality. I bought my violin in Cremona. It's the city of violins where, you know, Stradivari and Guarneri worked, and they still make violins there. All these little luthiers have their little shops, and when you go to buy a violin there, you can go to the central sort of consortium store where all the luthiers send their instruments, and you can play the violins for hours until you find the one you like. And, you know, when I try to explain how you know which is the one you like, I sort of think of it as like Harry Potter's wand. You just try them on until a wand finds you. But it's also a little bit like being a mother and hearing a room full of screaming babies. And you can, even through all these screams, you can hear your own baby. So that's sort of how I came to my violin. This is the one that was meant for me. So, you know, that mystical connection between violinists and violins is, I mean, it's something almost universal, and it doesn't matter what language you speak. We all understand what it is to play a string instrument.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing because it just takes you off into another world.
Yeah,
and
it does.
How you feel. It makes you feel so much better after you played. When I felt like I just wanted to say I got 90 hours of homework and it was too much, and my mother would say, well, you know, you have to practice the violin, and she looked at me and go like, that's not a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it was my sister wouldn't go near the piano. She didn't love it. She liked dance, but I said, you know, I loved the piano, but the violin sort of said something to me, and I said, you know, it made me stand out above everybody else.
I think it's sad that, you know, when I went on book tour, I would always ask, how many violinists are in here? And nobody raised their hands. It's like, you know, when I was growing up, I grew up in California, where we had, music, we had orchestra in elementary school, starting in elementary school, and we just don't do that anymore. So there's a whole, like, several generations of people who don't play a single instrument, who don't know how to read music. And I think it's a real loss because of something about music that that stimulates other parts of brain growth.
It does. I think it kept me going, and it was the one thing that in junior high school and even in high school that I loved. But I think the funniest thing is when I went into college and they told me I had a major in music. I wanted to major in languages. And they said, well, you're going to, you know, work in an elementary school doing whatever. You're going to teach music there. I go, no, not really. But they convinced me to major in music. That's the hardest major in the world. It's harder than anything because you can't study. You have to know. If they would take the needle of a record and just put put it in the middle of an aria of an opera, and you had to know where it was and where it fell. I'm like, oh my God!
It was hard. Yeah,
but
I think there's a reason so many Asian countries encourage their children to learn music.
Yeah.
And, you know, most Asian Americans, and I'm Chinese American, are kind of made to take music lessons, whether it's piano or strings. A lot of kids take strings. And I just think it improves your academics in other ways as well. So it's too bad that Americans don't require children to learn how to read music.
It's funny that you should say that. My niece is 8, and my nephew's girlfriend is Korean, and she's into the arts of music, and she teaches music in a school downtown in Harlem. And Penelope doesn't know, but she's getting piano lessons. And dance and everything. We're talking about that on Saturday. I said, you're going to get it all because your aunt and Julianne are going to make sure that you do.
Yeah.
which is great. So Julia appears to be sweet and loving and adorable, and Lily is smart and sweet, and yet she appears to want to kill her mother. So what was the first thing she decided to get rid of?
Well, okay. this is a point.
We're not going to
this
tell them too
point.
Much about it.
this is the point where my readers got really mad at me, because the first violent action that happens is the old cat that's been with their family for many years gets killed. And, you know, I know I don't like to kill fictional animals, but I do like to remind people this is a fictional animal that didn't really exist. And and in, you know, when you take into account what the rest of the story and what else happens to it, this is actually not the very worst thing that happens in the story. So yeah, the family cat gets killed, and this is such a shock to Julia, the mother, and she begins to wonder whether her little girl is something wrong with her. Is she evil? Is this something that a 3-year-old girl would do to a pet that everybody loves? So that's the first violent act the child does. And it happens while Julia is playing her violin. And the second time Julia plays the violin, her little girl stabs her in the leg with a piece of glass. So that's two violent acts that have been committed by this 3-year-old girl. And it always happens when she's playing the violin.
That's scary. That is scary, because it's the music that supposedly did it to her, or did it to somebody.
It's the music evil, and so this begins the long, arduous medical examinations of the little girl Lily. Where they go to neurologists, they go to psychiatrists, they try to find out what is wrong with this little girl. But in the meantime, her husband, Julia's husband, begins to even doubt the stories, because nobody else is there when these things happen. Only Julia and her daughter, Lily. And so her husband thinks, maybe it's my wife that's going crazy. And the problem is, Julia's mother did go crazy. She died in an insane asylum. So she begins to doubt her own sanity as well. So this whole family is spiraling into great misery, because they were so happy. They were such a happy family. And she brings home this music from Italy, and everything changes.
That's scary. That is scary. So they would relate this back to the past. What is the history behind Alberto giving Lorenzo his famous violin, and why did he give it a special name, and what's the significance of it? I think everybody names their instrument something.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people do name their instrument something, because I guess they're kind of like real beings to us. Alberto, who is the grandfather, has a 200, and this is another weird thing I'm going to tell you about later. So he has a 200-year-old violin that was made in Cremona, has been in the family, the Tedesco family, for generations. But his other grandchildren aren't interested in music, only Lorenzo. Lorenzo is gifted. Lorenzo plays the violin, and everybody in the street comes to listen under his window. Lorenzo has the fire of a true musician. So Alberto gives his treasured violin to his grandson, Lorenzo, because clearly he's the one who was meant to have the violin, which is who's named La Dianora, the sorceress. So that's where the violin comes from. And let me give you something that really kind of freaked me out a little bit. So I've written about this 200-year-old violin made in Cremona, which would make it have been built about 1739. Okay. After I wrote my music, Incendio, it was recorded by a fabulous violinist named Suzanne Howe, who's a concert violinist. And after she recorded it, she told me, you know, it's really interesting. I recorded the music on the violin that she has on long-term loan, and her violin was made in 1739 in Cremona. So it's as if this violin that I wrote about fictionally came to life and is now playing the music that Lorenzo actually composed. So another one of these strange coincidences in this project.
That is strange. I know. I wonder if Lorenzo would have created something like that himself, if he could have.
Well, I mean, in my mind, that this music that I wrote, Incendio, that's the piece that he wrote. That's the piece that I imagine he wrote. I know you've listened to the recording. It is available for people online. I mean, they can go to iTunes or Amazon. And I also have the piano sheet music if anybody – I know a lot of people don't play the violin, but there are a lot of pianists who might want to try playing the music on the piano, and it's it is available on digital in Amazon.
I have to look for that.
Yeah, just look up the just look up the word incendio, which is spelled like the Spanish incendio, and and with my name, and you'll find it's I think it's a 7-page piano sheet music.
Well, that's not too bad. I remember the first time I had to play in Carnegie Hall, I had to play the Waltz for the Flowers by Tchaikovsky and memorize it, and I was only 7. And I was like, once you do it once, it's simple after that. It's not a big deal.
Well, the piano,
but
the
it
piano
was scary.
Part, yeah, it's. I mean, the piano part is probably only for, I mean, it'd be like for an intermediate pianist. It's not that difficult. It's just there are a number of arpeggios that you just have to train your finger to do. That's all.
I think my hand could use a little practice for something other than typing. When creating the plot in 2 different time periods, how did you manage to keep it flowing? Like I said before, sometimes authors do that and I'm going like, what are you talking about? And what time period? Well, sometimes they go in the middle of a chapter or middle of a sentence or middle of a paragraph and all of a sudden they're talking to somebody else.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I can figure it out. And I'm going like, why are you doing this to me? Why are you torturing me while I'm reviewing your book? And so how do you keep it flowing so that everybody understands that this is the present and this is the past and then I'm going to bring it together?
Well, it was written in a strange way. You know, the story started off as a commissioned short story from my Dutch publisher, and they wanted it to be only 96 pages long. So I wrote the story just from Julia's point of view. So it was all a modern-day story, and she hears about Lorenzo's ordeal secondhand. She discovers it secondhand. So I finished that. I wrote all of Julia's section, and then I thought, you know, here I finished this. The Dutch are happy with this, and yet the other half of the story has not been told, and it's Lorenzo's story. So I wrote Lorenzo's section completely by itself. Both time periods are written separately, and then later on, I just intercut the chapters. So that was how I kept it separate, and how I kept it, without being confused, because they were really 2 different books that were wound together.
So that if you separated them into 2 different books, you could actually write them.
But they would be both novellas, and then putting them together makes it one novel.
So we have Lily, who everybody thinks is crazy, and
Julia, who thinks
she's crazy too. So, from a neurological point of view, what would they think would be wrong with her?
Well, at first they think the little girl might have epilepsy. They want to check and see whether the reason she's doing these outbursts, these sudden, completely out of character outbursts of violence. Is there something neurologic going on with this little girl who up till now has been completely normal? So they begin to do electroencephalograms. They do a particularly interesting one called it's one that you wear on a helmet so you can get deeper into the brain and see what's going on. Because what they're considering is that maybe she has something, which is a true neurologic condition, called complex partial seizures. And these are seizures where people they lose consciousness, but they don't fall down and shake. They just have abnormal behaviors, and they're not even aware of them. And when these things happen, people around them may not even notice anything's wrong. It's just that they stop being responsive. They stop talking. And they last a couple of minutes. They can last a couple of minutes. And when they're over, the patient does not remember anything. People have been known to do fairly regular things like, take off their clothes or go wandering or drive a car or just do something that is repetitive motion. So that's what they're thinking Lily may have. And it's funny because while I was, I got an email from a man who said, I figured out what was going on halfway through your book because I've been diagnosed with this condition. And I spent many, many months in a psychiatrist's office trying you know, trying to figure out what was going on. And that's really sad about these seizures, that a lot of people end up with psychiatrists because people think they're nuts when they actually have an organic disease.
That's scary. So what happens, what tragic event happens that the music play is related to fire? Why fire?
Well, okay, the word incendio means fire. That's the Italian pronunciation of the word incendio. And the word fire, I think that by the time you finish the story, you'll understand where that word comes from. And in a way, it's a spoiler to explain why it's about fire, but it actually has a very tragic meaning. And, you know, the meaning has to do a lot with the circumstances of the 1940s in Italy, early 1940s. A great deal of the story is historical. It's about what happened to the Jews in Venice. And it's something that I didn't know until I was in Venice that, you know, that time for my birthday, and I ended up in the old Jewish quarter. Anyone, you know, who gets to the old Jewish quarter, they'll find it's a very quiet space, very quiet square, and it has a number of memorials, you know, plaques set up around the square about what happened. You know, we know what happened in the Holocaust and in Germany and Western Europe. Most of, you know, Germany and Poland and Austria. But a lot of people aren't familiar with what happened in Italy, which was a really different situation. It was part of the Axis. The SS was in control. The Nazis were there. And while 90% of Jews in Germany died, in Italy, 80% of their Jews survived. So the question is, why? What happened? What was different about Italy? And I wanted to explore that in the book as well, because I found it both interesting and moving, and in some ways inspiring.
That is, my grandmother was in a concentration camp in Poland.
In Poland.
She came here. My grandfather went to knew that he and her sisters were there. Somehow he went through the underground in Poland and got her out after she went through a whole bunch of experimentation and torture. And when I was younger, I don't know why, she told me the whole story. Nobody else knew it. So I actually wrote it. I actually wrote her story, which I had published in a site that I work with. And I'm going to put it in my next book when I write the next person behind the gravestone. Because I don't think people know what these people went through. And some people still don't believe that it even happened.
No. I mean, and that's why so many of them went willingly. They didn't know what they were going to. I mentioned there's a section in Playing with Fire where everybody's, the Jews in Venice are rounded up and put on a train. And they're put on a passenger train. They're not put in a cattle car. And they're allowed to write letters to their neighbors, to friends. And a lot of them do write letters on this train saying, we're on our way to the labor camp. We'll write you when we get there. Everything is fine. And they're never heard from again. And they all assumed they were just going to a work camp. And they ended up in Auschwitz. So, I was in Auschwitz in June. It was just this year. And, you know, what struck me was this display of what people brought with them to Auschwitz. They brought cooking pots. They bought utensils. They thought they were coming to a camp where they would have to cook. And, the vast majority of them did not survive more than 3 hours when they arrived. So, yeah, they didn't know where they were going. And it took, that's why it just, the word took a long time to get out, because it was such a secret.
That's what's really scary, is that even the ones that survived and didn't had to have a purpose. I mean, they had to have some use to these people in order for them to keep them alive, because otherwise they would have been sent to the crematorium. I know my grandmother was in one of the concentration camps. I think it was in Dachau. And they were doing experiments on women. And when she came here, as far as I knew growing up, she had 5 children, 3 sons and 2 daughters. Needless did I know that my grandfather was married to someone else before, and she died when my mom was 2 in childbirth, and that my grandmother was my step-grandmother. It never dawned on me. You know, and I never knew, I never said anything ever until my mother told me later on about a story about how she found out when she was 15, somebody blurted out, and she never told them. My grandmother never, ever found out that my mother knew, because my mother was two. She found out when she was 15. And as far as I was concerned, my grandmother was my grandmother. She was the smartest person on this planet.
Yeah.
And she couldn't read. I taught her how to read and write. And
wow.
She was, and she couldn't see. She had her eyes were bad, so she would never. She went anywhere. She would count the number of steps because she knew exactly how to get somewhere.
Yeah,
by herself. But what they did to these people, I mean, is tragic, and the fact that people still don't believe it is even sadder.
Yeah, that means the deniers. It's because time has passed, and now it's easy to deny something that they don't have the didn't see the physical evidence of, which you know, and it's. But these stories have to be told again and again. And it's not just the story of those victims. It's just also the story of the people who were not Jews, who worked so hard, who fought so hard against it, and who died for it.
That's right.
I think that, you know, for my research, the most uplifting thing I found out were the stories of the heroes, like the girl Laura and her father.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many, many stories. There are probably 200 Catholic priests and nuns were executed for hiding Jews or for trying to get them out of the country. There were police officers who were told to round them up and refused. You know, there was a police chief who went around the night before to warn all the Jews, get out of town now because we have to come get you tomorrow. And there were entire villages in northern Italy who were ordered to hand over their Jewish citizens. And they just, every single person in that village just said, we don't have any Jews here. You know, just lied and lied and lied and protected their neighbors. So you see these stories, you think, why doesn't that, you know, that should have happened everywhere. That should have been the norm. And it is wonderful to know how many people did risk their lives to do that.
The scary part is if we don't watch out, it's going to happen again. That's what's scary.
Yeah, it is. It's, that's why history should be taught, because people have to be warned that the basic, you know, basic bad human behavior is always going to be with us, and it has to be kept in check.
Well, Julia's husband, Rob, what does Rob do that surprises Julia, and why? He's sort of like not really sure about something.
Well, you have to take Rob's point of view. He's married to this woman. He knows that she's a musician. She's an artistic kind of person. And Rob is an accountant. He's a numbers guy. He likes evidence. He likes hard evidence. And the kind of guy probably would wear a pocket protector if he were an engineer. Now his wife starts to behave weird. They think his daughter may be going insane, and he doesn't know why his family is falling apart. So he does what every logical man does. He seeks professional help for his family, seeks a psychiatrist out for his wife. He's just a man trying to figure out what's going on. He wants answers, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that he doesn't believe his wife after a while, because it's hard to believe what she's telling him.
It's scary. But then she goes off he tells her to go do one thing, and she goes off with her friend Gerda and doesn't say anything. How come? She winds up going to Italy to find out what really happened, but he doesn't know that she's there. She just goes.
Right. Well, he thinks that she needs to let the whole thing go. He says, you know, stop this now. Just give it up, because it's just driving our family crazy. And she feels it's the only way to get the answer. And so she defies his wishes, and suddenly, he says, I think you need to go in for psychiatric observation. And she feels like that's like going into prison. And this is my last chance to hunt down the truth. So she runs away. She escapes and goes to Italy.
And she does. Yeah, well, it's interesting what happens. So
and there she does find the truth, but it turns out to be a very, very dangerous truth, because even 70 years later, what happened to Lorenzo is still deadly.
Well, she meets a shopkeeper, and it sort of triggers everything. So how does he come into it? Because she finds this man, and she actually finds out something about him.
Well, the original man who sells her the music, an elderly Italian man, just happens. He runs an antique store. He collects stuff and he resells it, and he doesn't really know what exactly where the origins are of the things that he is selling. And doesn't understand that on his display shelf is something that contains a secret that's 70 years old, that is still dangerous to many people. And when Julie asks him to find out more about it, she puts him in danger, and he ends up getting murdered. So this is the first clue to Julia that this, it's not just a psychiatric illness that she has. That there is still evil at work, and that she is about to risk her own life.
That's just so scary. But what makes who is Clementina, and how does she come into it?
Well, this is after we find all the answers, almost all the answers, about what happened to Lorenzo's family, and we find out what's really happening with Julia and her family. There's one little piece of information that the reader does not know yet, because it happens in the historical times, and there's no clue about who the fate of this girl, Laura. Laura is the cellist who falls in love with Lorenzo, and they are forced apart when Lorenzo is arrested. So what happened to Laura? We don't know. And Clementina is an older Italian woman with family ties to Laura, and she gives you the final answer about what happened to Laura and her father. It's just the last piece of information to tell you, to what happened to all these characters.
It sort of ties it in. I know it's scary.
It does, and it explains something about Italian history, and explains something about heroes, and it also, and Clementina also has this when she looks at Lily, the little girl, who by now at the end of the story is like 12 years old, and is playing the cello. It gives you the sense that spirits live on.
Well, what is it? Rob at the end shows her a video that shows us something that's very telling and very compelling. How come he showed it to her? What would that do to help Julia?
Well, it helps Julia understand what really happened. It's a video it's a video of her testimony. She's testifying because she wants to make sure that what she has witnessed, what she knows, is on videotape in case something happens to her. During this video of her testimony, we see something that Julia did not even know existed. And it's sort of this, again, a final piece of evidence that helps convince her about the solution to the mystery, everything that's gone wrong. On this video, you see what she herself is not even aware of. And if I tell you more, it's a spoiler, so I can't say much
more
about
it. We can't do that. But before I forget, next Tuesday and Thursday, the double interview, Andrea Kane is celebrating the 25th year of her My Heart's Desire and Samantha series. And she's going to be on Tuesday at 10 and Thursday at 10. Tuesday, we're going to talk about My Heart's Desire. And on Thursday, we're going to talk about the sequel, Samantha. So that's going to be next Tuesday and Thursday. The next one, I'm not sure about November 9th because the author has not sent me the book yet. The Neely Girl, I'm supposed to read that and review her book. And Linda has not sent me. Lisa has not sent me the book. And in order for me to interview somebody to do it the right way, I need to at least see the book and get an idea of what it's about, even if I don't write a book review. The week after that, on the 31st, Bruce Larkin, Among the Shadows, that's a scary book. It was really good. And for those of you that ever heard of the Lacey Spears murder, the mother who poisoned her child by putting salt in his feeding tube, John Klatt will be with us on November 29th. So that should be really, 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 really interesting. And there are a few more in between, but on December 12th, we got the one and only John Land for Strong Cold Dead. And that's just some of what's happening in November and December. And for those of you that want to know, in February, I've got Brian Freeman, on February 2nd, Nightbird. If you really want to read something scary, that's scary. And my books of the week are The Devil's Work, Deep Dark by Laura Griffin. And for those of you that like David Baldacci, I just read the new one that's coming out November 1st, No Man's Land. If you really want to get scared, that was really scary. It was fantastic. So that's just some of what I'm up to. And I'm sure hopefully I'll be up to more. And hopefully I'll be able to review the 50 books that are staring me inside. So my goodness, it takes forever. What does the wealth of the crematorium mean in this particular book? I'm not supposed to use my hand because I sprained it and did something to it from using it, so I do it anyway.
I didn't hear the first part of it. What was the question?
What does the wealth of the crematorium mean in this particular book?
Oh, well, it has to do with the word fire.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, it's that is the meaning of incendio. It's why it was this piece is called incendio, because there, and this isn't just happened in Riviera di San Saba, which is the death camp that was located in Italy. It also happened at Auschwitz, and that very talented Jewish musicians were required to play music for various reasons. Apparently in Auschwitz, the music was played to, as workers went off to work. In Riviera di San Saba, which was located in Trieste in northern Italy, music was played to hide various unpleasant sounds. And maybe this was actually to hide it from the SS or from the Nazi officers who were running the camp. But the story that I saw from San Saba was that they did have a crematorium there. It was built by a German architect. But as the war went on, they ran out of bullets. I mean, they didn't use as many bullets, and they were somewhat careless about killing prisoners before putting them in the crematorium. So some of them were not dead. And the music was played to hide sounds, to hide the sounds of the dying. And that's partly where the music comes into the whole story, is that music becomes almost a soundtrack to the dying.
I know, and every time I looked at it, I could feel the flames. I listened to it, I could feel the flames. And the scary part is that there are people that knew this was happening, and nobody stopped it. That's just even scarier.
Well, that's what's most frightening, is that it was, people were, they tolerated it, they allowed it. But there were also psychological tricks that the Nazis used. And when I was in Auschwitz, they mentioned, the German soldiers would drop in the Zyklon B to gas all these people. But the feeling was that if you were to gas them and watch them die, it was psychologically too difficult for German soldiers. So they made a point of having the openings for the Zyklon B to be out of sight of the victims. So the soldiers would put in the gas tablets, but they would not see the results. It kind of isolated them from the horrors that they were committing. And that was one way that they arranged for soldiers to keep on doing what they were supposed to do, was to keep them separated from the people they were killing, to hide.
I wonder what would have happened
if
they actually saw it.
Even the Germans realized that would be so damaging. People would not be able to do that. That if you see the people you're killing, it makes it that much harder. And so they mechanized it. They found a way to make people who are normal human beings do things that they normally would not do.
It's pretty sad that they actually agreed to do it. And some of them, I get to take it from reading on, so many of them really took pleasure in doing it.
There's always a subgroup of people who find a thrill out of having such power, and it's really all about, the power of life and death.
I just wonder, one final question before we talk about more, what's next, is that what would have happened if Lorenzo lived in this time period? if it would have been different with Laura.
Oh, with, you know, nowadays they would be married and have grandchildren, you know? If
yeah, that would have been it. Wasn't there some, I'm trying to remember, there was a contest or something that they wanted to enter and they told them that they couldn't, and that she got up and played anyway? That was really good. I was like, yeah, good for you.
Well, that was, you know, that was true. They did have competitions back then, music. I mean, they've always had music competitions, but if you were Jewish, you were not allowed to compete. And these were, and Laura was going to have none of that. She said, you know, her feeling was that, look, we are the best musicians in this room, and we are going to compete together, and I don't, and you have no right to stop him just because he's a Jew. And so that's, in a way, it was just Laura being Laura. She wasn't going to put up with this stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you sort of see the future and her behavior then as a young girl and her behavior later, many years later, you know, during the war, and what this leads to.
That's just the saddest part about it all, I know. And if you stood up for yourself against them, they would just shoot you anyway.
Right. So the people had to make, a, you know, a decision. What do I do? Am I brave enough? Am I foolish enough? And it's something that I think it's an interesting exercise for anybody, even today. And it's an especially interesting exercise for young people. I mean, I kept the book purposely short because I thought this is really a story for young adults too. Mm-hmm. It's for people from, you know, it's for students from age, 14 to 17 in high school to read this story and think, what would I have done? Would I have been as brave as Laura? Could I have done what she did?
I agree. I think more kids need to read it as a textbook just to get an idea of what really happened. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, just to get up in front of, I taught reading and writing. I was a reading and writing specialist, still am. And the fun part was to get up in front of a group of children and get them to read something that was meaty. And that was great. And that had, you know, potential. I mean, I read To Kill a Mockingbird with my sixth grade class, and we talked about it. And the principal looked at me and go, like, you did what? I go, they were very extremely bright kids and in an inner city school in the Bronx. And I just ignored him, and I said, I'm going to do that. And I did Huckleberry Finn, and he said, why are you going to do Tom Sawyer? And he just looked at me. I said, no, I'm going to do Catch 22.
That's a little too old for them.
Yeah, I just, you know, like, The Invisible Man was good, too. And Little Women, Little Men, those are good, too. But I don't know. That group of children would have appreciated this.
I think it does, you know, awaken them to this is what happened. Yeah. This is what happened in 1939. Could that happen today? How do we stop it from happening today? What would you do if somebody ordered you to turn over your Muslim neighbor? Would you do it? You know, so I think it's an exercise that children should be going through, you know, going through mentally, because you don't know how to react unless you've somehow mentally rehearsed it. And then when it suddenly confronts you, you're ready with an answer.
Well, I remember after 9/11, because I was the dean, and I'm waiting outside, and there were a group of children that were threatening to beat up a child from Pakistan.
Yeah.
And he was new to the country, and little. I'm 5 feet tall. I'm very little, you know that. And I walked over to them. I said, I don't think you want to do that, because that would be a mistake. I said, and my phone's in my hand. I said, either I call your mother or I call 911. You're not going to beat him up. And they didn't.
Yeah.
Back off. And he looked at me, the kid. He says, you're so brave. I said, that's why they pay me not the big bucks to protect you. I'm the dean, and I'm not going to let anything happen to you. And I said, I'm going to make sure that this never happens again to you, because we're going to have a little peer mediation, and we're going to talk about it. I said, because there's no any child, anybody that wasn't, you know, from the neighborhood that lived there, anybody from a foreign country was ostracized.
Yeah.
And there was no, I mean, people you don't even know today. That's the sad part. You can see somebody walking on the street and you're not sure. So you're going to walk on the other side of the block, which you shouldn't. So what's next for you?
What are you writing next
that I'm going to get?
Well, I have another Rizzoli Nows book coming out next year. It'll be out August 2017, and it is called I Know a Secret. And here's the big news. My son and I have made a horror feature film.
Oh, nice.
It's called Island Zero. It's it's with the colorist now, so it should be ready for screening at film festivals by the end of this month. And it's about a little, it's about an island off the coast of Maine with fishermen. And one day the ferry doesn't come and everybody's phone goes dead and the power goes out and they don't know what's happened to the outside world. And every time they send out a fishing boat to the mainland, the boat does not return. So that's the story of Island Zero.
Where is it going to air? In the movie theaters or on television?
Well, it's it goes to film festivals next, and that's where it picks up that's where we're hoping to find a distributor. And if not, it will go direct to Amazon.
Well, let's hope so. And yeah, it's amazing. One of the authors that I know, Stanley Director, he's a screenwriter and film producer. I know him because he's my friend on Facebook, but he's also someone that I ask when I ask when I need to know something about something, that's who I ask. And he has a lot of pull. He's friends with all of the people from Happy Days and all of the old film stars. Yeah, he knows everybody. So when I needed to know something, I go, Stanley, can you help me? Well, that because I reviewed his book about people that got blacklisted.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, his book was really good. So tell everybody where they can learn more about you. I can't wait to get. I have to find out when this film comes out because I got to see it. And my husband loves horror, and I write horror. My next Faces Behind the Stone book is going to be called Revenge and Retribution. And it's told from the point of view of the dead person behind the gravestone.
Yeah. Oh,
and
cool.
It is cool. I don't claim to be wonderful and perfect, but the fun part at the going to the Thriller Fest was that I handed a copy to R.L. Stein. He took it. I don't know if he read it, but he did take it.
Well, so the name of the movie is Island Zero, and we should be having our movie trailer up on the website in the next couple weeks. And the website, which is not active yet, but it will be, is islandzeromovie.com.
I'm going to put that in my thing because I want to see it.
Yeah, so have people check it out in a couple of weeks.
I will. But thank you so much, and I hope I get the next book before it comes out. Because I like to read things before it comes. I like them before it comes out. And you're going to be at the Thriller Fest next year.
I'm not sure. Life has gotten so busy now that especially with the movie making that I'm not sure I'll be able to make it.
Well, if John invites me, I'll be there. That's the only way I get there because they count me as the media because of the radio show. So that makes me feel special.
Okay.
And it does because it's kind of expensive to go to the Thriller Fest, I can tell you that.
Yeah,
but
I know it is. It is. So maybe I'll see you there,
actually,
maybe not.
You never know. So where can everybody find out about Rizzoli and Isles and your other work on your regular website?
Oh, they can go to my website. It's at tessgerritsen.com.
Thank you so much. And if you want to do anything when the movie comes out, if you want to do another show to promote it, just let me know.
Okay, I sure will. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everybody. Have a wonderful day, and I will be back next Tuesday with Andrea Kane and next Thursday with Andrea Kane, New York Times bestselling author of the romance novel. Have a nice day, Tess. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
bye-bye.
Everybody have a great day. Bye.